Annie. Rickon is limping like a big baby. If you're in the race, he'll try harder. Danny had committed to the team, which meant obeying the coach, even when he was pushing his athletes too hard in an event that meant nothing. So he said, sure thing, and went to take his place at the starting line. The 200 was almost a sprint, like running a football field from one end zone to the other and back again. But it was Rickon's big event, and Danny wasn't going to shame him in it, even though Rickon was glaring at him as if jumping into his event had been Danny's idea. Danny passed a gate over Rickon, just in case he really had hurt his ankle like he said. Then, to be fair, he passed all the other runners through gates that took them no distance at all, but got rid of any fatigue or stress injuries or cramps they might be suffering. Let's have an even playing field, thought Danny. Everybody do your best. It turned out that Rickon's best was better than Danny's after all. Of course, Rickon actually cared, and Danny was tired. He hadn't passed himself through a gate, so he was still fatigued from the two longer races. Truth to tell, though, he might have been able to stay ahead of Rickon when he made his move at the end. But Rickon wanted it. It was his event, and Danny didn't want to be an asshole.
You asshole, said Rickon, still panting after the race. You let me win.
You mean I didn't trip you? Asked Danny. I didn't shove you?
You didn't sprint.
I ran the 32 and the 16 already today. I didn't have a sprint in me.
You moron, shouted Leader as he approached.
He talking to me or you? Asked Danny.
Must be me, because you're not a moron. You're an asshole, said Rickon.
But he punched Danny lightly in the arm and moved off. They both knew it was Danny that Leader was yelling at.
I send you into the 200. You run the 200.
Rickon and I left all the Rockbridge guys licking our sweat, said Danny. And Rickon didn't show injury, did he?
I don't send you in to inspire the other guys, said Leader. I sent you in to win.
Danny stood there. You got anything to say for yourself? Besides how I already won two races?
Without trying.
But without losing. Again a silence.
You're still at war with me, aren't you?
No, sir, said Danny. The 200 is Rickon's distance. He trains for it. He's better than me.
Bullpucky, said Leader.
Danny leaned close and talked softly. I told you I don't compete. I hate competing. Rickon competes. He cares.
Start caring, said Leader.
If I cared about track, said Danny, would I be at Parry McClure with you as my coach?
Danny turned his back and walked away.
Not toward the stands, not toward the team, but toward the fence, which he scrambled over almost like a hop and then across the road. To the untrained eye, it might have looked like he was walking off the team. But to Danny's more discerning perceptions, he was merely walking off the field because his last event was over. Leader must have seen this too, because he didn't yell at Danny to get his butt back with the team and all the usual abuse. Or maybe it was because Nikki was there talking to her dad, calming him down maybe. Or telling him that she liked putting her tongue in Danny's mouth, and so he'd better not piss the boy off. Whatever. Danny didn't go to the parking lot where the team bus was waiting. Instead, he started running up Greenhouse Road, away from Highway 11. Let it look like he was blowing off steam. What he was really doing was following the voices. He had learned to ignore the clamor of the captive gates. They were not so much voices as inchoate longings that did not speak to anything in Danny's experience. They felt distant to him, though in the abstract he felt bad about their long captivity. That vague compassion had been, he supposed, the reason he had included the most eager of them in the great gate he made in Silverman's barn. Hadn't that turned out well? The voices that had been Loki's own gates, however, were a different matter. At first their nagging chant had been like the pulse of a large beast, another heart beating somewhere in his body. Gate, 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 they intoned. And when he made the great gate, they had seemed to panic. But them, too, he had pressed down and kept at bay, so that he could concentrate on other things. He thought that it must be rather like tinnitus, the unceasing whine that some people hear constantly in their ears. You just learn to blank it out. But in the days since Loki had given his gates to him, everything had changed. The constant throb of gate, gate, gate was gone. At first, what remained had seemed to him like silence, except for the distant clamor of the captives that remained inside him. It was not silence, though. It was something different. These gates that had once seemed almost insane in their monomania were now attentive, observant. Danny felt himself being watched, but not in an unfriendly way, not by a stranger. Rather, it was as if his own inmost mind, the part of his mind that watched his conscious thoughts and responded to them, had been joined by others. They did not judge him, but they had suggestions. That was what had taken him a while to understand. They did not speak in words. Even the gate, gate, gate of the past had not been in actual language. It was deeper than language. He knew the meaning of the pulse of desire, but he could not have named the language it was being spoken in, and then concluded that it was no language at all. It was self-speech, as was their conversation now. Voices, then, but not words. And yet, remembering their suggestions, even a half moment later, he thought of them as words. His own words. His own language. Just as his conscious mind translated the impulses that came from his deep observer mind into language the moment they surfaced into consciousness. When Loki gave his lost gates to Danny, they had become, if not an actual part of himself, the most intimate of friends. They were on his side. Their suggestions were designed to help him do better. They did not care much about what happened with Coach Leader, because Danny didn't actually care that much. It was a part of the high school life that he had desired, but since arranging to come to Parry McClure, things had become quite strange, and the whole enterprise of American public education seemed a little pointless to Danny. Homework? Really? A track team? He was going through the motions now. To him, the only real thing about high school was his friends, his feelings about them. And Loki's gates agreed. About them, they had suggestions, though mostly they reinforced his own intentions. Don't let Xena think for a moment that you return her imaginary affection. Check. Pat might be something real. Don't mess with her or hurt her if you can help it. Check. Trust Hal, because he can be counted on, but recognize that Wheeler is the slave of impulse and doesn't know how to keep his word. Right? Right. Now, as he ran from the grounds of Rockbridge High, up to the crest of Greenhouse Road, and then down the steep slope toward the nursery that gave the road its name, he found that Loki's gates were the music giving meaning and rhythm to his running. Education. That was the idea they were talking about. Learning. He needed to learn. But they were not talking about calculus or social studies. There were things that Loki's gates thought that he absolutely had to know and didn't know. So he asked them silently, "What should I know?" Bellmage. Danger of the Bellmage. The danger that made us close all gates, prevent all great gates. Danger of the Bellmage. Immediately, Danny remembered the Fistok inscription quoted in that book in the Library of Congress. Here Loki twisted a new gate to heaven. Here Odin crushed the might of Carthage until the survivors wept in the blood of their children. Nasty stuff. An earlier time. Oh, like Hitler and Stalin and Pol Pot and Osama bin Laden were any better. That was not Loki's gates talking. What would they know of that? It was an interruption from Danny's own observer self, criticizing his own conscious thoughts. Nasty stuff earlier time had provoked his deep self to push a thought to the surface, refuting his own foolish conclusion. Of course, the moment the thought came to the surface, it became his conscious thought, while the observer self continued to lurk in the background. But now he felt the prodding of Loki's gates. Yes, 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 they were saying. Think about that. That's what you need to think about. What? Danny demanded. What was I thinking about? That's how Loki's gates differed from his own deep self. He never didn't know what his observer self was responding to. But Loki's gates were still not himself. They were his, they served him, but they were not truly a part of him. Yes, 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 they said again. Think about this. So they wanted him to continue this self-examination as he ran down the hill, staying on the right, the outside as he went around the blind curves because people took this road too fast and he had to make sure he was visible to them. They wanted him to think about the difference between his deep observer self and his conscious mind and the gates Loki had given him, and where were his own gates? Oh, such a good question. It was as if they applauded him. If Loki's gates talk to me, then why don't my own gates? And then he thought, or did Loki's gates put the thought into his mind? The reason my gates don't talk to me is that they are me. For all I know, they do talk to me, but I hear them as myself, as no, no, no. It was like playing hot and cold as a child, the cousins all yelling, warmer, warmer, hot, hot, cold now, as the child who was it searched blindly for the hidden object. This memory had come unbidden. Did that mean it came from his own gates? No, no, no. Then what are my gates doing? He asked aloud. And then, as he came to a stop at the bottom of the hill, where a complicated three-way intersection with Furze Mill Road was too narrow and dangerous for him not to pay attention, he realized, who has been operating my body as I ran down this hill thinking all these thoughts? It wasn't my observer self. That was listening to my ponderings. It certainly wasn't my conscious mind. It was doing the pondering. I have no memory of anything I did, any choices I made coming down the hill, and yet I was making them. I was passed by several cars. Now I can remember vaguely that they came from behind and ahead, several of them, but they never interrupted my conscious thoughts. My gates were operating my legs and arms, keeping me on the road. I had a mindless task to perform, keeping myself alive while running, and I turned it over to someone else while my conscious self and my deeper observer self were engaged in this inner conversation. And it all came together. While Loki had been asleep in a tree for 1,000 years or so, he had set most of his gates to carrying out a simple but urgent task, watching the world for gate mages. And they had stuck with that task the way his own gates, his outself, had taken care of his running body while his mind was otherwise engaged. But Loki had freed his captive gates from their old unceasing assignment and given them to me. They weren't watching the world anymore. They were watching the world. They were still doing what Loki had set them to do, but they were reporting to me. Or rather, preparing me to be ready for battle. And he realized that this realization had come from the voices. Or at least it had been confirmed by them. They want me to learn about the Bellmage, because now that there are great gates in the world, and a gate father capable of making more of them, me, I am the person that the Bellmage will come after. The words of the inscription came back to his mind. We have faced Bell, and he has ruled the hearts of many. Bold men ran like deer from his face, but Loki did not run. Of course, this wasn't the Loki whose gates Danny now had within him. It was a much earlier Loki, one who had defeated Bell in his day. Loki found the dark gate of Bell through which their god poured fear into the world and through which he carried off the hearts of brave men to eat at his feasting table. What did that mean, actually? Was it something like what the gate thief did? But more of the inscription came to mind, and his observer self realized that it was the voices that were pushing it to his attention. The jaws of Bell seized his heart to carry it away. Loki held tight to his own heart and followed the jaws of the beast. Wasn't that the very passage that Danny had used to guide him in overcoming the gate thief? That had to be what it meant, didn't it? That Bell was a gate thief, too. Loki tricked Bell into thinking he was captive, but he was not captive. His heart held the jaws. The jaws did not hold his heart. Yes! That's what I did to Loki. That's how I defeated him. And when he found the gate of Bell, he moved the mouth over the heart of the sun. Let Bell eat the sun and drag it back to his dark world. He has no more home in Middlegard. That was the end of the inscription. What am I missing? It sounds like Bell is a gate mage, not a man mage at all. Then it dawned on him. Just because the inscription was ancient didn't mean that the person who wrote it knew what he was talking about. Was it written by that earlier Loki himself? Doubtful. It was written by somebody later, repeating what he had heard. Had he heard it from Loki's own lips? Maybe. But would that even matter? If the writer was not himself a gate mage, would he understand anything that a gate father said about what he had done in fighting the Bell Mage? He was at the top of Furze Mill Road, where it intersected with Highway 11. Danny turned right onto the bridge and ran along it as the light turned green and cars and trucks set the whole bridge to vibrating like an earthquake. It always did that. It was nothing. Once again, Danny had no memory of coming up the hill. Only when something different came up did his running come to his conscious attention. I have been following that ancient inscription because it gave me the idea that helped me overcome the gate thief. But the Bell Mage is definitely not a gate mage, and the inscription sounds as if it's a battle between two gate mages. That's what the writer probably thought it was. But Loki, this Loki, the one I know, the one whose gates are inside me, he realized what the Bell Mage really was. If the Bell Mage had been a gate father, it would have done no good to take all the gates. So the inscription accidentally taught me how to fight another gate mage, but it taught me nothing about how to fight a man-mage. And not an ordinary man-mage anyway, the Bell-mage. Bell-mage, 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 echoed the voices. Who in the world can teach me about the Bell-mage? Danny asked. Nobody in the world today, that's who, Danny said to himself. For 15 centuries and more, gate-mages and man-mages have been killed whenever and wherever they were caught. How can anybody possibly tell me about the Bell Mage? Loki, that's who. Yes, yes. But he doesn't tell me anything. If I'm supposed to learn from him, why isn't he here teaching me? He won't. He won't. Then how can I learn? Who knows? Silence. You know, Danny said silently to the voices. You know. Loki won't tell me, but you know everything he knows. And you serve me now. You're mine now. So instead of obeying him and keeping silent, you're going to teach me. Silence. So teach me. He was off the bridge, so the vibration under his feet stopped. Solid ground felt almost boring after the bridge. He stopped and waited till traffic cleared so he could make the dangerous crossing of Route 11 to get on McCorkle Drive, which was far safer to run on than 11. You're not going to teach me, Danny said to the voices. Silence. But you want to teach me. Silence. Danny thought about how he couldn't remember much about the running that had been controlled by his own outself. He realized that the voices had brought that memory to his mind, a memory of what he had failed to remember just a few minutes ago. But it hadn't been their memory, it had been his. They didn't have memories. They could only prompt me to remember what I already knew. Well, that's a dead end. I can't remember what I never learned. Remember. How can I remember? I never knew. Re-member. We. Re. It was so vague. No words. He had no words to explain to himself what they were trying to say. You do remember. Remember. But you can't tell me what you remember. Almost. Warmer. Warmer. He thought again about how he had been able to think back and remember the cars that had passed him. Cars that he hadn't been conscious of when they passed him, and which he had forgotten until he tried to remember them. But then the memory had surfaced. Sort of. Vaguely. You remember, he said to the voices. But you don't remember that you remember. Something has to call up the memories. You have to be tricked into remembering. You have to be reminded in order to remember. The voices flooded him with relief. He was right. He was also standing on the edge of Highway 60, directly across the road from the combination McDonald's and Citgo station. How could he possibly already be here? No way had that much time passed. But it had. He could think back now and remember every curve of McCorkle Drive, every uphill and downhill. He could even remember what thought he had been thinking at each stage along the way. The distance he covered had nothing to do with how much thinking he got done. And now he remembered that he had been distracted repeatedly by other thoughts. He had thought about Pat and wondered what it would be like to sleep with her. Had thought about Zena and realized how dangerous it was to let himself think about her much more powerful sexuality. Thought about Nikki Leader and wondered what her game even was, and wondered even more how she had figured out that he had done something to heal her. Yet he also remembered thinking a clear chain of thoughts about the Bellmage and Loki's gates and how they put thoughts in his head and whether they could remember things, and this was their demo. They were showing me how they held together a clear, continuous chain of reasoning, even though I actually got distracted by thoughts of women and also by some of my anger at Coach Leader. I had been thinking of that when I actually crossed 11, about what an asshole he is, trying to get me to stick it in Rickon's face. I thought about so many things. I wasn't concentrating on one thing at all. But something kept pulling me back. Something held on to the thread. It isn't just running that the gates, the out-self, can take care of for me. It's also my thinking. They have no language, they can't tell me any memories, but they can prompt me to think back and recover the memories. There's still the problem that I don't have Loki's memories, so you can't prompt me to recover them. Silence. But you didn't prompt me to remember anything, Danny said to them as he realized it. I prompted you to remember it, and then you fed the memories to me. That's what you want to do. You want me to somehow prompt you to tell me what Loki learned. Yes, yes, yes. How? And then, for a long moment, he became profoundly stupid. Completely lost. He stood there looking blindly at the road, seeing nothing, and thinking absolutely nothing. A complete stupor. A police car pulled up in front of him. The window came down. Danny walked over to the window, bent down to look inside.
I couldn't tell if you were trying to cross the road or what, said the cop.
Danny realized that the "or what" might have something to do with throwing himself in front of a semi-truck. Just deciding whether to go to McDonald's or just run back home to BV.
You're going to run to BV?
Danny indicated his clothes. I was at the track meet at Rockbridge.
They have a team bus.
Coach Leader pissed me off, said Danny. The cop grinned.
Okay, I get that. Just, if you cross the street, be careful. You looked like you were about to cross, but you somehow froze in mid-step. You know, like a freeze frame in a movie.
I had no idea, said Danny. Just got caught up in an argument I was having with Bleeder, inside my head.
Well, just remember, nobody ever wins an argument with the coach.
The cop gave him a little wave and drove off, the window rolling up as he went. Nice guy. Danny turned to face south on 60. Stay on the left side, don't cross the street. He didn't run, he jogged, shambled really. What was that about? He asked the voices. What had he been thinking about when he suddenly got so stupid? He was asking the voices how he could prompt them to tell him about things that only Loki would remember. And then he realized. They had demonstrated something. That had disconnected him from the moment. Or they had disconnected his own gates, or distracted him. Something. They had done something so that his body didn't just keep on doing what he told it to do, the way Loki's gates had kept on following his instructions while he lived in a tree, the way Danny's outself had kept on running his body while he thought about other things. He thought about how he remembered what he had been thinking about during each stage of his run along McCorkle Drive. He had mentally gone back to the process, going up this hill, making that turn, passing this driveway, going down the hill, looking at the highway on-ramp, seeing the McDonald's sign. He had mentally retraced all the steps. But he couldn't retrace the steps that Loki had taken, and he had not. but he could trace them.
Do you know where Loki learned the nature of the Bell Mage? A sort of vague approval. You can't tell me where.
Yes, yes, yes.
But you can take me there? Again, vague approval. Danny jogged left into a driveway, past a building, to the back of the parking lot, behind a tree and some bushes, and made a gate. He had no idea where the gate was leading. He left it up to Loki's gates. Don't tell me where I need to go, because you can't, you don't know. Just take me there, because what you have is not word memory or even picture memory, it's kinetic memory. You remember what you did, and then the other kinds of memories come popping back. Yes, yes, yes. There was the gate. He stepped through it and found himself in a bare stretch of desert, and it was nighttime, and it was cold. But there was a lot of moonlight, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky, so he could see just fine. His first thought was Mojave Desert, Death Valley. Then he realized America hadn't even been discovered when Loki lived in Middlegard. And this was too bone dry. And, duh, in the Mojave Desert it would be 3 hours earlier than it was in Virginia, and so it would be even earlier in the day. Here it was night. He was on the dark side of Earth. He looked at the position of the moon, the stars. He wasn't a fanatic about it, but he knew how to locate himself, roughly, if he did a little thinking. Plus, he also knew where all his gates were. They were far beyond the curvature of the Earth, but he was at just about the same latitude as the gates at Vivi's place in Naples. That meant going due east and figuring from the time of day, he was somewhere in the Sahara. He remembered how he had made a gate that took him and his entire PE class a mile above the high school. Maybe he could get an aerial view of this desert, and maybe guess why Loki's gates had brought him here. But instead of using a gate to go vertical, he climbed a rise to the east. When he reached the crest, he looked down and saw that the bone-dry desert went right to the edge of a river in a deep valley. Lots of lights, a city across the river, and some of it on his side, too. The river ran north-south. He was on the west side. Upstream, to his right, there was a lake and a huge dam. Then it became obvious he was in Egypt, within sight of the Nile, just downstream from the Aswan Dam, across from Kitchener's Island. Thousands of people all around. A tourist with no visa, no passport, and not a word of Arabic. But when Loki came here, if he came here, nobody spoke Arabic. That was the language of obscure barbarian tribesmen across the Red Sea. The language of the common people here was Coptic. The educated spoke Greek. The religion was Christian. What now? He asked the voices silently. And then out loud, are you remembering anything yet? It was vaguely comforting to hear his own voice. He knew as he asked the question that this isn't how he would get the answer. He had to walk through the memory. He had to take his own body where Loki had gone, and then let the memories wash over him. Not his own memories, Loki's. He had to become Loki, act out Loki's part, and then he'd be able to remember what Loki had seen and heard, just as he had remembered, just a moment ago, his run along McCorkle Drive, and everything he had thought about and noticed as he ran. So it was a kind of time travel. There is no way this is going to work. He felt the need to make a gate, and assuming that feeling came from the voices, he made the gate and stepped into it. He was standing in a wadi. Sand had flowed like a river through here, carried by wind, though, not water. And so it would have piled up, not washed down, building up like snowdrifts, not fanning out like silt in a stream. He walked where it felt right to walk, trying to let memory wash over him, and failing. Because it was wrong, something was wrong. He needed to walk somewhere that didn't exist. Only it did exist. It was just buried in sand. He needed a shovel. He gated back to Lexington, where it was still afternoon, though starting to get a little darker.
He popped out behind the Lowe's on the far side of the Walmart. He walked in and bought a shovel and a pick. Then he thought of a better plan and went back and bought two more shovels. A minute or two later, he interrupted Hal and Wheeler playing some game on the Xbox at Wheeler's house. "This couldn't wait?" asked Wheeler. "Got to do it while it's dark," said Danny. "So we've got a couple of hours," said Hal. "While it's dark in Egypt," said Danny. They were smart guys. They got it. They just didn't like it. "I don't even like digging in the sand at the beach," said Hal as he dubiously eyed the sand-filled wadi. But Danny set to work. Without insisting, they do anything. "Just help as much as you want to. And if you want to go home now, the gate's right there." Danny didn't even look at them. Just started digging. Pretty soon, they were digging beside him. If they had been archaeologists, they would have proceeded methodically, slowly. But they weren't archaeologists, and this probably wasn't even an excavatable site. Because as Danny and Hal and Wheeler dug into the sand, Danny began to remember the place. Not his own memories, of course. But he knew without knowing how he knew just who had lived here. A monk. A Christian ascetic. Not one of the ones who collected disciples, but one of the few who avoided them. Only Loki had gone to him. There was the cave, or rather, the depression in the cliff. It's not like he had to stay out of the rain. And since he had chosen a south-facing cave, he wasn't even staying out of the sun. No, he was staying out of the sight of people who came looking for him. He really didn't want to be found. Did he want to die? Suicide would be a sin. This was a holy man. He didn't want to die. He had a friend who brought him water, and he shielded his face, his whole bald head, from the sun, under a little awning. "I came here," Loki came here, "and brought his own water, and then just sat here, day after day, saying nothing." Danny remembered it, the silence. After a few days, on Sunday actually, the hermit said in Greek, "Go away." In that instant, Danny remembered gating away, right in front of the man, letting him see that he was a gate mage. Of course, it was Loki who had done that. Whatever he wanted from this man, it depended on the man knowing just what Loki was, what he could do. "You stop digging," said Hal. "Are we done?" Danny broke out of his reverie, out of the memory. It had been so real. Even though it was dark here right now, and it had been broad daylight when the hermit told Loki to go away. This was going to work. "Yeah, we're done with the digging." "Cool," said Wheeler. "Now I get to explain to my mom why I'm covered with sweat and sand." "Just go shower," said Danny. "I'll gate you right into the bathroom if you want." "Somebody will be in there," said Wheeler. "Every hour of the day and night." "My house," said Hal. "You can shower at my house." "My clothes?" asked Wheeler. "It's not like any of yours will fit me." Without another word, Danny gated with them to Wheeler's bedroom. "Pick out some clean clothes," said Danny. Wheeler did. Danny gated with them to Hal's house. "Shower here?" he asked. "Fine," said Wheeler. "I don't know why you were sweating," said Hal. "It's not like you actually did anything." "I worked my ass off," said Wheeler. Hal just looked at him. "Compared to regular me, I was digging my ass off," said Wheeler. "I'm going back now," said Danny. "Thanks. You saved me a couple of hours of solo digging." "Not to mention how we got to see all the sights of Egypt," said Hal. "I'll take you back there someday," said Danny. "In daylight." "No way," said Hal. "It's just a desert. I'll look at pictures on Google Images. Give me a break." Danny gated back to Egypt and sat down in front of the hermit's cave and let Loki's memories flow back through Loki's gates.
Chapter 16. Frostinch. Annonoe had never been in Gray, though the shadow of that kingdom had darkened her entire life. Or perhaps brightened it. If Gray had not defeated her homeland of Iceway and imposed harsh terms upon it, including the loveless marriage of Bexoy, the sister of the Jarl of Gray, to Priard, the heir to the throne of Iceway, would she ever have become Priard's mistress and mother of his sons? No. She would have become his wife. Once she understood that her power over men was far greater than the ordinary allure of women, she knew she could pick any man in the world to be her husband and win his undying devotion. Priard, handsome, kind, intelligent, powerful in Majory, and heir to the throne of the only kingdom she knew, would have been her choice. But he was already tied to Bexway when Annonoe came to understand her power. So yes, it was due to Gray that she became Priard's mistress instead of his wife. Priard's former love for her might have been achieved through her illegal, immoral, indecent man-majory, but her love for him was genuine, and still was. Annonoe wanted her vengeance on Bexoy, of course, enough that she would use the power of her cruel captor Wad to achieve it. But she also truly wanted what was best for Priard, despite the fact that once he was torn away from her influence, he fell in love with the Gray bitch. And Annonoe had learned enough about men in general, and Priard in particular, to understand that his true happiness did not depend on which women inhabited his bed and bore his children. For him, happiness would be the liberation of Iceway from Gray. And since that would also happily coincide with Anonoe's vengeance on Bexoy, she was content. That was why she had watched through the tiny windows Wad made for her, spying on the Jarl of Gray and on his son and heir, the beautiful, conniving Frostinch. With him, no sexual allure would be believable. He seemed to have no interest in sex of any kind. If Annonoe knew anything about man-majory, it was that whatever she got other people to do had to be the kind of thing they already tended toward, or other people would suspect some kind of ensorcelment. It was power Frostinch hungered for, and so she would use his lust for domination as the tool to bring Bexoy down. She was ready now. She knew enough about Frostinch to speak the language of his heart. And now that her majory had been so vastly magnified by passages through a great gate, he would be unable to doubt her. So it was that as he sat on his chamber pot, one of the few times he was ever alone, she appeared in his close room. She wore nothing magnificent or revealing. She had dressed herself carefully in undyed homespun, with her hair drawn back in a severe bun. It was the garb of what passed for holy women in Gray. As she expected, Frostinch took her presence in stride. The only sign of his surprise was that his bowels loosened in that instant, filling the small room with the fetor of his troubled digestive system. "So, there is a gate mage in Westall," said Frostinch softly. "There is," said Annonoe. "But I am not that mage." "What are you, then? My assassin?" "If I were here to kill you, I would have come in behind you or simply pushed a knife through the gate," said Annonoe. "I am the enemy of your most dangerous enemy." "Yet you speak with the accent of Iceway," said Frostinch. "And Iceway is my most dangerous enemy." "Neither of us is fool enough to believe that your most dangerous enemy is a land your father subdued years ago, a land that lies under his heel," said Annonoe. "Your greatest enemies are Greyish by birth, and of the royal house." "My father is not my foe," said Frostinch, "and there is no one else in Grey powerful enough to aspire to be my enemy." "Pay attention," said Annonoe in her most contemptuous voice. Instead of letting him be angry at her, she turned his immediate resentment into a grudging respect. If this woman spoke to him with contempt, then perhaps he deserved it. Perhaps she was wise. Perhaps she could be used. And if she regarded him with contempt, then perhaps he could turn that against her. Let him think he was superior to her, and simultaneously wonder if she might be superior to him. That would keep him listening, weighing all she said. "Born of Gray," I said, "not in Gray." Frostinch gave a single contemptuous laugh. If you mean my Aunt Bexoy, then your gate mage has chosen the wrong emissary. Your disdain for her is proof of your stupidity, said Anonoe, if more proof were needed. All your plotting, and it never dawns on you that she has outmaneuvered you at every step. My aunt, the sparrow twit. She got pregnant by Priard, that's all. It complicated things, but it didn't change anything important. She blocked all your father's spies from access to Priard, which means that the spies that secretly served you are also blocked. She did nothing, said Frostinch. He washed his backside, something his father used servants for, but Frostinch trusted no one enough to allow them to stand in that position. You're wasting my time. No, you're wasting mine. I told my friend you were too arrogant and stupid to save. He won't listen to a woman, I said. I won't listen to a fool, said Frostinch. You don't even know your aunt, said Anonoe. She left for Iceway before you were 15. I sat with her while she told me stories and watched how she couldn't even get sparrows to obey her, no matter how much she fed them. And it never occurred to you that the disobedience of the sparrows was proof that she was not a bird mage at all? Why would anyone claim to have such a pathetic power if... His voice trailed off. It was a pleasure to see him realize that he had indeed been stupid. He dried his buttocks. You claim that she had so much foresight that she thought a child was worth deceiving? The heir to the Jarl of Grey? A boy who had already shown himself to be an ambitious little monster? No offense intended, of course. Frostinch smiled. Anonoe had understood him well. Ambitious little monster was no insult to him. So she was deceiving me then in order to blind my eyes today. And until this moment it worked, didn't it? You thought she was a tool you could use and that when that tool was taken from you, it was Priard's doing, not her own. You have no evidence of anything like that. Fool, said Anonoe. I'm here, am I not? After spying on your every conversation for days. And you think I wasn't able to spy on her before? That I do not know exactly what I'm speaking of? That I don't know how she arranged to deceive your agent Luvix when he tried to murder her? In that instant, Frostinch's pose of languid unconcern evaporated. What do you know of that? I know that your aunt has the power to create a clant so vivid that when he stabbed the clant, it bled. He believed he had succeeded. No one can make a clant that... Then he concentrated on refastening his breeches. You saw this? My friend saw it after he stole the poison Luvix had intended to use and gave it to Bexoy. Anonoe watched him process the fact that she had known of the poison. And you have been spying on me? He asked. She repeated his conversation of the day before with one of his agents, whom he met in a garden, pretending she was a woman he desired. He did not understand that no one believed anymore that he had the slightest interest in women. He listened, nodding. So either you have been spying through a gate, or my dear and trusted friend has betrayed me. She has not betrayed you, said Anonoe. But by all means have her killed. Destroy another of your own weapons. Make yourself weaker. I'll wait till Bexoy has trapped you and made you her puppet, and then you'll be ready to listen to me. But alas, you'll also be completely useless to me by then. So you'll betray me in order to curry favor with Bexoy, hoping she'll drop you a crumb of power. Only she'll laugh at you. Anonoe is dead, she'll tell you. You? Asked Frostinch. Anonoe? Priard's mistress? Not as dead as everyone assumes, said Anonoe. And your sons? Alive and out of your reach, said Anonoe. Just as I am out of your reach. She knew before she said it that he already had his hand on the dagger he kept in the back of his trousers. Now he whipped it out to slash it across her body. But she stepped back into the gate Wad had prepared for her, reappeared directly behind him and shoved him forward. Already overbalanced by his own lunge, he toppled over. It gave her time to pick up his chamber pot and pour it out onto his body, spoiling his clothes. "You are nothing, Frostinch, compared to mages with real power. I have passed through a great gate." "Impossible," he said. "The gate thief allows no..." "Don't you know how to think?" she demanded. "It does not occur to you that my friend is the gate thief?" He laughed nervously, getting up, reaching for something to brush the foulness from his clothing. Then he pulled off his tunic and unfastened his trousers, standing naked and completely uninterested as he regarded her. "My body is washable," he said, "and I can get my clothing cleaned. These efforts to humiliate me are pointless." "So is your attempt to slash me with your dagger," said Anonoue. "I came to offer you our help against your aunt, but you remain too stupid to realize how much you need our help. Has Vexoi passed through a great gate as well?" "If she ever does," said Anonoue, "she will rule all of Westall. Without passage through a great gate, she is the most powerful mage of our time. Even with my passage through a great gate, I doubt that I alone am any match for her." "If she's no sparrow friend, what then is her magery?" asked Frostinch. "Why should I tell a fool?" asked Anonoue. "You are the sparrow friend, the weakling. Couldn't you see how she mocked your pathetic magery?" "I'm a hawk, brother," said Frostinch. "Hawk?" asked Anonoue. "Oh, so I've heard. But the birds that come to you, the birds you ride, the birds who spy for you, all I've seen you use are crows." He grinned. "Crows are little noticed. Alone, they steal whatever I need them to steal. In a pack, they can tear the meat off an enemy in minutes." "I don't disparage the many talents of crows," said Anonoue. "What I despise are people who pretend to be nobler than they are. Hawk friend." "I have ridden hawks," said Frostinch. "They shuddered at your presence and tried to kill themselves to be rid of you." For the first time, he was genuinely angry and humiliated. "How could you know that? It was years!" "I have spied on you for days, but the gate thief has watched you for years. When you're dead, who will be the Yarling of Grey?" His face went ashen. "Is that her plot?" "She has high hopes for her son by Priard. Your father and you think you have nothing to fear from the baby because you imagine that she has no talent to pass on to him. Here is the power she has. Power to rule in his name. Once you are dead, have no doubt that your father will name this baby in her womb to be his heir. Then, when he is born, both your father and Priard will die. Very differently, but die they will. And she will rule in the baby's name. Have you any doubt that such a plan would work?" Frostinch walked to the window. His skin was covered with goose flesh, though it might be the bitter cold from the window. He kept his close room cold, the windows uncovered. To kill the stink, perhaps. Or to make him feel that he was strong and hardy, a true man of war, instead of the man of crow-like cunning that he was. "What do you hope to gain from me?" he asked. "If she's so powerful and clever and dangerous, then she'll succeed and I can't stop her." "True," said Anonoue. "She has already blocked you at every point. But there are things you could do that would prevent her plot." "I already tried to have her killed," said Frostinch, "though not because I feared her." "No, you merely thought your father was coddling Iceway for her sake, and you wanted to have another bloody war and kill Priard and wear the crown of Iceway on your own head." "Why should I be a mere Jarl when I might be a king?" "Fool to care about the title," said Anonoue. "Power is the only fact. Titles are decorations. Names are lies. Do you finally understand that until you see things as they truly are, you can accomplish nothing?" "How are things really, then?" he said defiantly. "You're naked and cold at the window," said Anonoe. I could push you out. And then you'd have no use of me. Exactly, said Anonoe. And Bexoy has not killed you yet, because until she has a child that she can show your father and use to win his heart, you are more useful alive. Only when he is already the doting uncle, impressed with Priard's loyalty to him and his devotion to your father's younger sister, only then will your tragic death lead to him naming his nephew as his heir. So I have time. A little, said Anonoe, if you know how to use it. And what do you and your friend, the gate thief, if that's who he really is, intend for me to do with this time you say I have? Isn't it obvious? Said Anonoe. Kill your father now, and become the Jarl yourself. Then she stepped through the gate and returned to Wad. The gate thief shook his head.
He used to be clever, said Wad. You made him stupid.
I made him believe that he was stupid, said Anonoe, and then told him how to be clever. I hardly need to be a man-mage to do that. Learned people do it all the time.
But I saw your man-magery all the same, said Wad. He practically worships you.
Most men do, if I want them to, said Anonoe.
Will he kill his father? Asked Wad.
He'll try, said Anonoe. And because he really is clever, he'll probably succeed even without our help.
But you intend to help him.
Kill the man who defeated and humiliated Iceway? Yes, I think I will. Unless you stop providing me with gates.
Remember how few of them I have, said Wad.
So passage through the Great Gate didn't increase their number?
It increased how long they last, how strong they are, my ability to manipulate them, my sense of other gates and where they lead. But no, passage through a Great Gate does not add any new gates to my store.
Nor, apparently, does it make people any smarter.
It didn't improve your intelligence or mine, said Wad, but we were already as clever as we needed to be.
As is Frostinch, said Anonoe.
Yet it didn't occur to him that he should find out what your majory is?
I didn't let him think of it, said Anonoe. That's elementary. Whenever he became curious about me, I distracted him. Again, I barely needed majory to control him.
When he is Jarl of Grey, he won't be any smarter.
I don't want him smarter, said Anonoe. I'm not going to use him to defeat Bexoy. Man-majory doesn't let me add new powers to my clients. They are what they are. He will be my puppet, but no match for Bexoy.
Who is? Asked Wad.
You, said Anonoe. But I don't expect you to face her down either. You're still too much in love with her. Wad recoiled at that.
She murdered my son.
The son you made with her. Remember what I am, and believe me, Wad. However much you hate Bexoy, you still have love enough for her that it will make you hesitate at the last moment, and she'll destroy you.
How will you bring her down, then? How will you defeat her? Do you think that you're man-mage enough to make her your servant?
Watch and see, said Anonoe. When it's over, you'll be the only one who knows what I have done. But you'll agree that my victory was perfect and complete. I could find no better way to punish her.
And you won't tell me now?
You would prevent me, said Anonoe, even though you think you wouldn't. I'm not controlling you, but do need to use your talents. Not knowing, you'll continue to help me, even though you know that if you knew my plan, you wouldn't.
Wad smiled. Or so you think.
You think that you would approve, and so you help me, said Anonoe. I don't have to use man-magery on people who are sure they're wiser than they are. But of course she did use man-magery on him. She used it on everybody. She used it all the time. But part of the power of man-magery was the ability to make its victims believe that they were freely doing what she manipulated them to do. That would be her vengeance on him
for those years of torment and captivity, for the damage that he did to her sweet son, Eliuik. But because he had also saved them, and because of all his help to her, she would never tell him of how she controlled him. So he would not suffer. She could enjoy her triumph over him, and enjoy the fact that he so ignorantly enjoyed it too.
Chapter 17. Ka and Ba. How do you learn anything with your brain switched off? Yet Danny quickly realized that this was exactly what he had to do here in the Egyptian desert. Loki's gates didn't actually know anything or remember anything, except at one remove. They remembered where Loki had been when he learned powerful secrets about the Belmage, and they remembered what he had been doing. So Danny had to be where Loki had been and do what he had done, and then let memory flow into his mind. Memory that was not his own, of things he had not done. And the memory included no language. It only included what Loki came to know at a level below language. The moment Danny tried to make sense of the memories, his conscious mind took over, and his conscious mind introduced language. Language drove out the inchoate, wordless Loki memories. So he could not make sense of anything while it was happening. He had to let it wash over him. It required a sort of trance. His conscious mind had to be off in space, not concentrating on anything. It is so hard to concentrate on not concentrating. So at first the memories were jagged. They flashed in and out like lightning. There was no coherency. Images of a scrawny, sunburnt Egyptian man, small in stature, bald, his shoulders tented by thin white linen, a dusty linen kilt around his loins but otherwise naked. The memory included heat, and then cold and darkness. The man was talking, but Danny heard no words. He did not want the man's words, though this man was the teacher, some kind of hermit that Loki had consulted. A man who knew ancient lore of Egypt, knowledge older than Christianity, though he was certainly a Christian ascetic. But the memory of his words could not be recovered this way. Instead, Danny had to recover the memory of the story that Loki had built up in his own memory. When words came to mind, then they were not the hermit's words. They were the words that mattered to Loki as he listened. Ka, ba. But as soon as Danny attached to the words, their meaning in this context fled away. Fortunately, the memory could be endlessly started over, repeated again and again. The gates were patient. What else did they have to do? So as Danny gradually mastered the art of meditation, at least well enough for this purpose, this day, the memory began again. And now it washed over Danny and became his own. Later, he told himself, I will remember remembering the memory, and that will become the story. For now, let it flow. Let it fill you. He had no idea of the passage of time. Captured by the memory, he did not know if it was day or night where he sat alone in the desert in front of the cavelet that he and Wheeler and Hal had cleared of sand. He only knew what the time was in the memory as it flowed through a long, long conversation. A couple of times, breaking the memory flow, he despaired. Loki had placed all the things the hermit told him into a context of Loki's own experience with gates, with mages of every kind, in a world where magery was far more common, where a gate mage was educated in his family's history and knowledge and skills. How could Danny, in his ignorance, possibly make sense of any of this? He let it flow. He let it flow. And then a hand touched his shoulder. That had not happened before in the memory. Who was it who interrupted Loki? Danny waited for the memory of Loki turning to see what he saw, to know what he knew. Then the hand touched him again, more sharply this time, shaking him, and Danny realized, this is not in the memory. This did not happen to Loki. This is happening to me. Please, he whispered. His voice was a feeble croak. Please, wait. The hand shook him again, very hard. It almost knocked him over. Danny felt like weeping, did weep one great sob, and then the intruder